You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Arié Nayar. I'm very pleased to welcome you here this afternoon for a discussion of the new book by David Rode and Kristen Mulvihill, A Rope and a Prayer. A kidnapping from two sides, and the two sides are David as the kidnappee in the border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Kristen as his wife trying to secure his release. During the several months that he was being held by the Taliban. It's a book written by both of them with alternating accounts of their experiences. And we're going to proceed this afternoon by asking David to speak first, and then asking Kristen to speak. A word of background on each of them. David had been working for the New York Times in Afghanistan and Pakistan, was writing a book about the Taliban at the time that he was kidnapped. Previously, David had worked for the Christian Science Monitor at the time of the war in Bosnia, and he was the person who discovered the Srebrenica massacre, and he received a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the massacre at Srebrenica in 1995. He was also, at that point, detained by Serb forces for 10 days. So this was his second experience at being held in captivity for his reporting. At that time, the United States was able to apply pressure to secure his release. That didn't work for him in the case of kidnapping by the Taliban. Kristen Mulvihill, his wife, they had only been married a couple of months at the time the kidnapping took place. Kristen has been an editor at women's magazines and had to, of course, learn what it is like to try to negotiate for the release of a victim of kidnapping. And David, of course, had to learn how to be a kidnappee. So, David, if you would go first.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. This is a homecoming of sorts. This book was written in an office upstairs, or at least my half of it. And Arié's been has supported my work since my days in the Balkans. OSI actually gave me a grant to complete this book, and all of the staff here were incredibly welcoming. Many are close friends. Laura Silber has been a friend from years since the Balkans. Justin Burke and I both worked at the Christian Science Monitor. I'll just go by first name now forever. Erica is a good friend actually a friend from college. Anthony Richter's work, Jim Goldston, and everybody, Maureen Ang Twin was fantastic. Ronnie Frankel, even and Sandra Williams, I thank you all for welcoming in these offices and sort of encouraging me as I wrote the book. I also want to talk, and we can ask questions about him, but about Richard Holbrooke a bit. Arié mentioned my previous captivity and my more recent one. In both cases, Richard Holbrooke did absolutely everything he could to try to free me And you know, it was sort of an analogy for what he faced in the regions, in that when I was kidnapped in the Balkans, he was sort of able to pressure the Serbs into releasing me. When he tried his very best to pressure the Pakistani government to make a larger effort to find me and get a Taliban group that, you know, I believe is a proxy of the Pakistani military, when he tried to pressure the Pakistanis, he didn't have as much luck. And it's just because it's a different dynamic and a more difficult dynamic in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I will talk about my captivity. I'm going to talk about it in a pretty detailed way, focusing particularly on sort of empirical evidence that I saw of this link between the Pakistani military and the Taliban faction that had kidnapped me, known as the Haqqani Network. I'm going to be more detailed because I think this is probably an audience that wants that kind of detail. We were kidnapped just outside of Kabul in November 2008. I'd been invited to this interview by a Taliban commander that I was told was a moderate, that he was sort of aligned with Mullah Omar and the Quetta Shura. He had given interviews with two other, they were European journalists, and not kidnapped them. I met with one of them the night before my interview, and she said, it is more dangerous for you because you're an American, but I don't believe he'll kidnap you. I think he's trying to use the media to get the Taliban's message across. I met him an hour outside of Kabul in Logar province, and I didn't actually meet him. I was on my way to the interview when two of his men blocked the road with a car and then jumped in our vehicle, and a second car appeared and drove us off into the desert. We were quickly moved from Afghanistan into Pakistan. In terms of the Haqqani family's immediate involvement, at the least they were involved 48 hours into the kidnapping. The New York Times started receiving calls and demands for ransom from Badruddin Haqqani. He is, in terms of the Haqqanis, Jalaluddin Haqqani was actually an ally of the United States. He received CIA funding in the 1980s to fight the Soviets. He is the patriarch and now very elderly. His younger son, Sirajuddin or Siraj Haqqani, now runs the Haqqani network. Badruddin, who was involved in my case, is a younger brother of Sirajuddin, and it seemed like he was trying to use me to kind of make his name in the family and boost his reputation, and so was this commander who invited me to the interview. He wasn't a Haqqani relative, but he was clearly aligned with them. We were, when we were moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan, we had to cross four different Afghan provinces. And during that time, we were moved from district to district in Afghanistan. There were Haqqani network commanders that would meet us as we got to the borders of every district and then escort us through their district. They were very highly organized. We moved in a very nondescript way. I was basically in the back of a station wagon with a scarf over my face, and there was maybe one or two motorcycles accompanying us. I never saw any American security forces or Afghan government security forces during what was essentially a three-day drive. What happened at the end of the third day was it was dark, and our kidnapper announced that we had to get out of the car and walk because there was a large American military base blocking the road ahead of us. We spent the next 9 hours walking through the mountains. When we arrived in the morning, we were picked up by a young Taliban militant, and we drove into a town. I saw signs for Wana, and we had actually walked over the mountains from Afghanistan's Paktika province into the South Waziristan tribal area of Pakistan, and Wana is the sort of capital of South Waziristan. We were then driven up to Miranshah, North Waziristan, which is the stronghold of the Haqqanis. All government checkpoints, all Pakistani government checkpoints on the main roads in Waziristan had been abandoned, and instead of Pakistani soldiers or police standing there, there were Taliban who had Kalashnikovs, and there was a Taliban password that our car had to give them to move through the areas. In Miranshah itself, the Haqqanis were in complete control of the town. There was one Pakistani military base, but I never saw or heard of Pakistani soldiers coming off of the base other than for resupply efforts. In the different houses where we were held captive in Miranshah, the Taliban, specifically the Haqqani commanders, had set up radio towers on the roofs. They had these ICOM walkie-talkies that they used all around the town, and the radio towers would boost the signals. They were so confident that a day after we arrived in Miramshah, I was taken out into a riverbed, and they let me place a call to my wife, Kristen, from a Thuraya cell phone. Thuraya's can be easily traced, but they didn't seem to, you know, they didn't seem to be concerned at that point that it would be discovered that I was in North Waziristan, Pakistan. One small detail, and this is down in the weeds, but for interest of people who follow Afghanistan, on the second day I was in Miramshah, Badruddin Haqqani sat me down and made a point of explaining to me that the Haqqani network was loyal to Mullah Omar and beneath him, and they were not a sort of separate Taliban organization, as the American military said. That's roughly a false statement. I mean, the Haqqanis do basically work on their own, but it was interesting to me that, at least for the outside world, and I assume for Afghans, it's important for the Haqqanis to pretend that they're loyal to Mullah Omar and part of this broader movement. During our captivity, it was very important to Badruddin that it appear that we were being held in Afghanistan, not Pakistan. At one point, he drove us for 3 hours to find a snow-covered hillside. And this was in, you know, basically 2 months into the kidnapping. During the drive to this snow-covered hillside, he planned to shoot a video of us there. Again, all the checkpoints were abandoned, and we actually ran into a Pakistani Army resupply convoy. In defense of the Pakistani Army, the Pakistani soldiers were visibly afraid of civilian vehicles as they drove down the road. They were afraid that, you know, there would be a car bomb attack on their convoy. And what happened was there was a civilian vehicle in front of us, and when they saw the Pakistani Army convoy, they pulled over immediately. Badruddin Haqqani, who was driving our car, pulled over as well. All of the civilian passengers got out of their car and let the Pakistani Army convoy pass. But in our car, only Badruddin Haqqani, the driver, had to get out. I was hoping that this, you know, resupply convoy might stop and search our car and maybe they would rescue us, but they simply drove past, and Badruddin actually waved to the Pakistani soldiers. He got back into the car and said to me that under a truce between the Taliban and the Pakistani army, civilian vehicles, all the passengers have to get out when a resupply convoy passes, but Taliban vehicles, only the driver has to get out. That allows them to hide kidnapped victims like myself in the back seat and foreign militants as well. I'll just raise drone strikes briefly. I'm happy to take questions on that, but there were drones constantly overhead during my time in captivity, and the Taliban did fear the drone strikes. They were generally accurate. They do kill civilians, obviously, but I found that the Taliban exaggerated the number of civilians killed in general. They got very angry, for example, when a drone strike killed a large number of Uzbek militants. My guards took classes from Uzbek militants in Miramshah on how to make roadside bombs that would kill American soldiers, and they considered the Uzbeks sort of great mujahideen who had come to help them. They were so concerned about the drone strikes. There was a belief among the Taliban that the U.S. government was trying to kill me in a drone strike. They felt that I was this tremendously valuable prisoner that gave them tremendous leverage. So out of concerns for drone strikes, they moved us from, again, Miramshah, North Waziristan, the Haqqani stronghold, to the town of Makin, which is in South Waziristan. That's the stronghold of the Pakistani Taliban, particularly their former leader. He was subsequently killed in a drone strike by Tula Masood. So for 5 weeks, we were held in Makin, this South Waziristan, the stronghold of Baitullah Masood. And I was concerned that, you know, we were essentially being sold by the Haqqanis, the Afghan Taliban, to Baitullah Masood and the Pakistani Taliban. Instead, I saw seamless cooperation between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. We were given a house in Baitullah Masood's area, but our guards remained Haqqani fighters. And when we left, you know, the Haqqani fighters and us were allowed to leave and go back to North Waziristan. I had feared that the Pakistani Taliban would try to essentially kidnap us and keep us for ransom themselves. One last point, near the end of our captivity in Miramshah, there was rumors of an offensive that the Pakistani army might actually come off their bases and try to retake control of Miramshah. My Afghan Taliban Haqqani guards bought a bunch of hand grenades and ammunition. They were eager and ready to fight the Pakistani army. They generally despised the Pakistani army. then a radio, an order came over the radio, and all of the Afghan Taliban were told to not fight the Pakistani army, i.e. the Haqqani network would not engage in direct combat with the Pakistani army. The local Pakistani Taliban instead would fight the Pakistani army. This fits a sort of broad suspicion among people, and I have the same suspicion that the Pakistani army has a sort of tacit understanding with the Haqqanis where they allow them to operate in North Waziristan and don't fight them. There are some American intelligence officials who believe they also receive, that the Haqqanis also receive money and weapons from the Pakistani military. I will basically now turn this over to my wife. I was escaped from captivity in June of 2009 after 7 months being a prisoner with my two Afghan colleagues, and I'm just delighted to be here and delighted to be married to this woman.
Thank you for coming, and thank you to OSI and Arya. As he mentioned, I had a very steep learning curve in this process. I had actually just started a job at Cosmopolitan magazine as photography director 2 weeks before he was kidnapped. And so I actually found out at work on a Monday afternoon. I had just put the finishing touches on a shoot called, and this is not a joke, My Bra Saved My Life, which was about a hiker. It was a dramatic first-person account. I don't want to belittle her experience, but it was about a hiker who got lost in the woods and injured herself, and she hung out. She had a bright red sports bra on. She took it off and hung it on a branch to alert passersby. And, you know, after sort of putting the finishing touches on her shoot and arranging for her to be photographed, the next call was from my brother-in-law, Lee, David's older brother, stating that David had gone to an interview that he never returned from, and it was an interview with the Taliban commander. I hadn't been aware of the interview, so it all sort of took me by surprise. But when David's away reporting, you know, we typically speak twice a day. So when the afternoon rolled around, I expected he was going to be traveling to Pakistan that day, and I expected a call from him, not from his brother. Very quickly, I was thrust into this world of, intrigue and politics and whatnot. The FBI is the lead agency on kidnappings of American citizens, whether it's at home or abroad. They very quickly swooped in, spoke with me, spoke with our entire family, and told us how the case might progress based on history and whatnot, and encouraged the family to try to spark private negotiations. Now, the FBI, you know, trained me how to take phone calls from the captors. The captors did call me twice in the middle of this whole ordeal. I actually spoke with David on week one, and I was advised to extend the calls. I was advised to say I was praying for him, which I was, and to not make any specific promises, but really try to get them to keep calling. With this in mind, you know, we had to entertain the idea of talking about money and prisoners. We were willing to do that as a family if it was the only way of keeping them talking and the only possibility of seeing David and his fellow hostages alive again. The New York Times also was very helpful. I met with them, I think, 12 hours into the case. I was in touch with Bill Keller from the very first moment, and as well with David's colleagues in Afghanistan. Initially, they were trying to plead for humanitarian release, and it became pretty obvious that wasn't going to work. The demands were $25 million, and they wanted 15 prisoners from Guantanamo. As the case progressed, it decreased slightly, but actually the demands would sort of waver. So on the outside, we weren't quite sure if he was being sold up some kind of food chain or being passed between Taliban groups. You know, we were always told that he was held by the Haqqanis, but we didn't know if they were trading him around and whatnot. So it was very frustrating. We made the decision to hire private contractors because it to be able to negotiate. The FBI cannot negotiate for you. The reporters, you know, it was a security risk for them to be trying to work on the case from Kabul and the offices there. And they were conflicted about the idea of offering money. So we did hire a private security firm, which was interesting because we had the newspaper working on it. We had a private security firm. We had newspaper's crisis management team, and we had some government officials. So it was quite a mix of people, and very difficult to to know sort of who to listen to. I didn't feel there was any one person that knew it all, that knew the local culture and had negotiated in the past. So it was just a very difficult experience to navigate. I actually had David's password to his email account, so one of the first things I did was I broke into his email account and looked for people in the region and in New York that I knew he had interviewed in the past or was friendly with, and I contacted them. One of them was Zal Khalilzad. I met with him in New York, and he actually advised me, you know, to try to have an advocate in the U.S. government. He suggested that it be Richard Holbrook, and separately, a good friend of David's put me in touch with Holbrook. We spoke about 2 weeks into the captivity. He told me, you know, to reach out to Condoleezza Rice and the State Department and try to keep in contact with them to keep David's case at the forefront. He also told me that there was a rumor that, you know, in 2 months he might be assuming a post with the Obama administration, and he promised me that when he did take that position, he would work on David's case. He would make it a priority. And he absolutely, you know, he lived up to that promise and did more than any government official to help us. One of the things in particular, which I can talk about, is he went to the ISI, the Pakistani Military Intelligence Agency, and pressured them to try to pressure the Haqqanis to get David released, or at least to continue talking with our family. The captors would go quiet for weeks at a time, 6 to 8 weeks at a time, and we kind of, those were the worst moments, were the moments of silence. Our imaginations would run rampant. You know, we had no idea if we'd hear from David again. But anyway, he did go to senior ISI officials. He also arranged for our family to meet with senior people in the Pakistani government. And in the early months of the kidnapping, I was told by them that, you know, it was a very sad situation. They felt badly for me, but didn't I realize David was indeed in Afghanistan, not in Pakistan? And then as the months rolled on, he escaped at end of June. In May, Holbrook again helped our family attend the AFPAC summit in Washington. And we met with another senior Pakistani official who actually told me that Holbrook had informed him David was in Pakistan, and that was a surprise to him, but they would try to help. He went out of his way to stress that they didn't communicate with the Taliban and with the Haqqanis specifically directly, but they had emissaries and cutaways that would go in and deliver messages back and forth. He actually never referred to the Haqqanis by name. He called them the most despicable people. you know, he did assure us that they would try to do what they could. In the end, it's unclear as to whether the ISI didn't have the level of influence we thought they did, or if they simply, you know, didn't really do much to help beyond perhaps telling David's captors not to kill him, but, you know, do what you want in terms of a release. So this was a very difficult thing to navigate. In terms of the Taliban and actually speaking with them on the telephone, there were moments of absurdity throughout this case, the greatest of which was, you know, when they would call, they would tell me to look at the number on caller ID and call them back because they didn't have money on their phone cards. So it was like adding insult to injury. They're asking for millions of dollars and prisoners and could I pick up the tab? But that lapse, actually, that having that moment to have to call them back always enabled me to catch my breath and sort of stay calm and not blurt out anything inappropriate on the phone with them. Some of the things I did learn is, and David as well, the young men holding David were fairly tech savvy. They Googled family members. They Googled my brother-in-law, Lee, who was working very closely with me on the case. And Lee works with an aviation consulting firm. It's only four people, but he's the president of this small company. And they told David, you know, oh, we know your brother manufactures jumbo jets, and why can't he just sell one jumbo jet and get you out? And there was a perception that all Americans are millionaires or have access to large amounts of money. So they really, you know, did not want to come down from their demands. they did release videos of David, and I would occasionally, I tried to maintain my job in the early months of his captivity, so I would occasionally be contacted by the FBI, you know, around lunchtime, could I duck out and view a video of David. I always wanted them to tell me, to reassure me, you know, that it wasn't an execution video, or to let me know what the content was ahead of time. And they were very gracious about making sure the family saw videos first, before the newspaper, before anyone else. Because even though our case was not in the media, it was not private. So many people knew about it. And, you know, David's colleagues, there was tremendous camaraderie in keeping the case quiet, and we'll take questions about it if you like too. One of the points, though, with the video, just to underscore what David said, they would always go out of their way to say that they're in Afghanistan. And in fact, the video he mentioned, the location shoot, as I would call it, was somewhat comical. You know, they went out of their way to shoot hillside, a snowy hillside, so we'd think it was Afghanistan. I recognized all the photo tricks. They'd sort of put the camera on a really steep angle to make the hills look higher. As I said, that was one of the moments kind of just very strange and surreal to see that. In terms of kidnapping, one of the things that was really difficult is there isn't a coordinated effort between governments. So while our government doesn't pay or negotiate, other governments have. The French have paid in the past. There was a case of an Italian hostage where some prisoners were released. So his kidnappers didn't really distinguish, you know, oh, the U.S. government won't pay. They absolutely believed that that they might, and that was a very difficult thing to work against. I realize our experience is very extreme, but in writing the book, I really hope it resonates with anybody dealing with a situation of uncertainty, whether it's being separated from a loved one or if you have a spouse that's ill and you're making life and death decisions for them. I would say this experience is akin to that. So I really hope it resonates just beyond our specific experience. And I guess with that, we'll take questions.
Thank you very much. Before I open it up, if I could pose a question or two, I'd like to start with a question for you, Kristen. And that is, you mentioned that a lot of people knew about the kidnapping, and at the same time, it was not publicized. And I wonder if you would say something about the strategic considerations in not making the kidnapping public.
We weren't dealing with a legitimate government. We were dealing with insurgents. And so we really felt that if the case became public, it would perhaps give them a platform to try to negotiate directly with our government, which we knew wasn't going to happen. I stand by the decision. As I said, I know that it went against, you know, every journalist's instinct to report the news, but I do think he's here in part because of that decision. It wasn't a decision we made lightly. We revisited it every week, depending on what was going on in the world and depending on communications from his captors. At one point, I think it was the second video we received, the captors actually had David say, you know, please have journalists write about us. And that was a really tough call. I could tell by the way he was delivering that line. I mean, I knew everything was scripted, but by the way he delivered it, I could tell that was not coming from him, and I didn't think he thought that was a good idea. I mean, it was just sort of something between, you know, wife and husband. You kind of know how someone says something. So we maintained the silence. One of the things we did was very basic. We put David on Google Alert because there were a few bloggers that wanted to report on it, and also to update. They wanted to update his Wikipedia page. So one of David's colleagues at the newspaper, Michael Moss, this is in the book, would go in periodically and check the Wikipedia page and remove references to the kidnapping. There had been somewhat of a precedent before this. I actually met with a man by the name of Jerry Van Dyke, who'd been held captive a few months before David, he told me, you know, keep it private. His case had been kept out of the media. I met with his producers at the news outlet he worked for, and they advised me the same thing. His case had not been reported. A day before David was kidnapped, Melissa Fung was released, and her case had been kept out of the news as well. So there was somewhat of a precedent, and I know, you know, the Times took a lot of heat for it, but I'll always be grateful that they honored our request.
And David, if I could ask you a question, and that is, in your contacts with the Taliban and conversations with your captors, did you alter in any way your thinking about the motivation or the how they define their own cause? Did it alter your thinking on that subject?
It did. I want to thank one person who also works for OSI but isn't usually in New York, and he's an incredible friend of ours, Chuck Sudetich, who's sitting here and is going to be angry because I'm pointing at him. He's another old friend from the Balkans, you know, an incredible journalist and writer and person who was so supportive to Kristen while I was away, so we want to thank him in particular, and Emma Daly, who's sitting next to him. Anyway, I want to make it clear, the Taliban were much more hardline, the ones who had me in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and what I'm about to describe does not necessarily apply to all Taliban. I think there are, you know, young Taliban fighters in southern or eastern Afghanistan who are sort of fighting for control of their village or valley or district, and they don't have the same beliefs as my captors. But the reality of what I found in the tribal areas of Pakistan was that it was sort of a fulcrum where young Afghan and Pakistani Taliban spent all these times with foreign militants. There were Arab members, Arab militants in Miran Shah. We heard about them. You know, we assumed that they were Al-Qaeda members. And my young Afghan and Pakistani guards, you know, would talk about a legend they had heard of an army emerging from Khorasan. This was the ancient name of Afghanistan, that would conquer the holy cities in Saudi Arabia and remove them from the control of an apostate government. They watched videos that sort of portrayed a worldwide assault by an alliance of Christians, Hindus, and Jews against Muslims. They had been told that the 9/11 attacks were staged and that American troops were forcibly converting Afghan Muslims to Christianity, and that Afghan women were being forced to work as prostitutes on U.S. military bases. They didn't say this specifically, but other Taliban propaganda says that, you know, young girls, when they go to schools, are taught to be prostitutes, and that's why the Taliban blow them up. It was really stark. I lived during the Israeli assault on Gaza. My Afghan Taliban guards were furious as the number of casualties among Palestinians rose. And these videos they watched show Muslims basically being, you know, murdered, and no one in the West cares. And they're very exaggerated, the videos, in Kashmir by Indian forces, in Chechnya by Russian forces, in Iraq by American forces, you know, and then in Palestine by Israeli forces. And this is all part of a sense of, so their motivation is to sort of defend their faith and their culture from this unprovoked assault that they see as a religious war that's trying to eliminate Islam from the face of the earth. I'm sorry it's so stark, but that's okay. What's happening in the tribe.
All right. With that, let me open it up to questions. Steve, do you want to go to a microphone? Why don't you introduce yourself as well?
When you were first captured, you blurted out something about, I can get $1 million or something like
Correct.
That.
Yes.
And did that lead to their feeling that maybe they could, you know, work out a deal somewhere down the line with that kind of money?
Yes.
And the second question is, if you could describe your escape,
sure.
Which I think is most interesting of all of us.
On the second night of the kidnapping, I didn't know who had kidnapped us. The Taliban commander who had abducted, who invited me to the interview, covered up his face after we had been taken into captivity, and he pretended to be someone else. And he told the two Afghans who were with me, if you tell David who I really am, I'm going to, you know, chop off your heads. So I didn't know who had us. It's the second night of the kidnapping, and this guy says, Arabs are coming, and an Al Jazeera film crew, and we're going to decapitate all three of you and film it. So I immediately said, we're worth more alive than dead. And he said, well, what can we get for you? And I thought of this Italian case. There were five prisoners released for an Italian journalist. There had been a case of Korean, a group of Koreans being kidnapped, and millions of dollars was reportedly exchanged for them. So my first answer was money and prisoners. And then he said, well, how much money? And I said, millions. And I don't know if they had all, you know, there's a chance that elevated our value, and that was a mistake.
I think it kept him alive in the early days, all three of them alive. And he insisted that it always be a deal for all three of them, which I think also helped the other two hostages.
They always had planned, because, you know, they knew it was American, to grab me and take me to Pakistan. I don't know, you know, but I think it was a mistake to have said that. But an example was that they, you know, whatever I said, money and prisoners and millions, their reaction is, okay, $25 million in cash and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I remember saying to them, like, this is insane. And by the end of the captivity, they were, their demands were $8 million in cash and 4 prisoners, which is just, you know, completely insane. They, we decided to escape because they were just sort of, they lived in, I call it an alternate universe in the book. They believe that, if you remember the case of the American sea captain that was kidnapped by Somali pirates, and then three of them were shot by American snipers. Again, as Kristen said, they Google, they watch the news all the time. They did not believe the public report that the U.S. Navy had killed the three Somali pirates. They said, oh, no. Instead, the U.S. government had secretly paid a $25 million ransom. And we basically had started looking for any opportunity to escape. We were moved to a house in Miramshah that was the closest of any house we'd been held in to the Pakistani base in town. And at the same time, in the new house that had been used by fighters before us, there was all this junk, sleeping bags and pots and pans. And on one shelf, I found motor oil and a wrench and a car tow rope. And the last thing that happened was we were lied to yet again about the negotiations, and then the power came back on. And we decided very quickly that one afternoon, it was June 19th, that we would try to sneak out that night. The power kept the ceiling fans running. There was one in the room where we slept, and there was a very crude air conditioner called a cooler that are very common in South Asia, and that made a tremendous amount of noise also. So I waited a couple hours. The guards appeared to be asleep. And got up, snuck out of the room. My colleague and fellow kidnapped victim, Tahir Ludin, an Afghan journalist, came with me. We then used the rope to lower ourselves. Went up on the roof of the house and used the rope to lower ourselves down a wall. We then walked to the Pakistani military base. When we arrived at the base, the guards at a check post thought we were suicide bombers. I had a beard down to about here, was dressed in local clothes. We explained who we were. We spent about 10 minutes standing with our hands up in the road, and they said, if you move an inch, we'll shoot you. They let us walk over an earthen berm and come closer to them. Then we had to lie down on the ground. Then finally, we stood up and we offered, and they agreed that we would take off our shirts to show we didn't have suicide vests on. And I was allowed on the base, and I'll, you know, this wonderful young Pakistani Army captain welcomed me, apologized to me for what had happened. And he gave me a book called The Glorious Islam, which was a much more moderate interpretation of Islam. And he told me how, you know, how vehemently he opposed the Taliban, how he thought that they had skewed his faith and didn't really represent Muslims. And most importantly, he, you know, let me call home. I was afraid that other Pakistani army officials, particularly ISI officials, might hand us back to the Haqqanis. And I was able to call New York. And the phone rang in New York, and my mother-in-law picked up the receiver, and Kristen can tell the rest of the story.
I actually had gone out that night. I hadn't been out in weeks, and I was in Battery Park, a couple blocks from our apartment. My mother called, completely frazzled, and said, you know, David's escaped. Come home now. Run home. And I ran home. When I got there, she had written all the details. She'd gotten all the details accurate, the name of the captain, Miranshah, and she'd written them all on sticky notes, so they were, like, strewn across the sofa in the living room. It was kind of comical, actually. And but very quickly, you know, we got on the phone. We called foreign editor at the New York Times and someone else in the paper who'd been working with us. They ran over. And between the four of us, we were able to contact, you know, Hillary Clinton, Richard Holbrooke. I had all these people in my BlackBerry at this point. And we were able to say, you know, this is where David is. And they, in turn, contacted Pakistani officials and said, we know David's in Miramshah, make sure that he gets out alive. And that really served as a safety net. You know, throughout, we had questioned going to our government because we were told by the security team that it might actually elevate David's value. And it was a very difficult decision to make, always, with everything we did. But in the end, having met with so many officials in the U.S. and from abroad, everybody, you know, knew about his case, and it really helped in terms of getting him back home, or actually getting him to Dubai, which is where we were reunited.
Okay. Other questions?
Hi. Letta Taylor from Human Rights Watch. Did you bond with any of your captors? Did they bond with you? And I don't mean necessarily Stockholm Syndrome, but what was that relationship over the months? And I think the second question, I'm not expecting you to have an answer to this because it's something I grapple with myself all the time looking at these issues, but do you have or did your experience change any views you might have had on on ransom payments or prisoner swaps? Thanks.
I bonded with some of my guards, but even the ones that sort of, you know, seemed to kind of see me as a human being, lived in this alternate universe. The one I liked best told me that he was eager to have as many children as possible because the Afghans had to prepare for the next invaders, which would be the Chinese. And he separately believed that the U.S. was using some kind of weapon that would sterilize Muslim men in eastern, you know, Afghanistan. And you know, and he was sort of the most moderate of the group. I had other guards who, and I just apologize for being so stark, but I feel like a duty to describe this. They saw me as sort of inherently unclean because I had not converted to Islam. I would do chores in the house and would wash the dishes. As the months went by, they asked me to stop washing the dishes because I would have stomach problems from the food. I was treated very well. I was never beaten. And I was even given bottled water throughout my captivity. It was a humanitarian thing in one sense, but it was also a business move in that they called me the golden rooster, and they wanted to keep me healthy to sell me at the highest price. But they basically believed that when I had stomach problems, it was because there were these diseases festering inside me because I was impure. They gave me an English language Quran, and then would get angry when I would touch it. At first I was allowed to read it, and then when I sort of didn't convert immediately, they asked me to kind of hold it with a scarf over my hands because it was an insult to them, they felt, to their faith, if a non-believer touched this book. And they were, you know, very bigoted religiously and refused to sort of eat food off the same plate that I used. There was one moment where this very kind, and I will emphasize these moderates, like this captain, there was an old man who appeared in one place where we were being held, and he scoffed at my young guards and their refusal to kind of eat, you know, food from the same plate that I was eating from. He said if David were to, you know, take a piece of bread and, you know, chew it in his mouth, you know, I would take it out of his mouth and put it in my own mouth, because he said we're all God's creatures, and he's God's creature as well. In terms of paying ransom, it's hard for me to say. You know, I was very lucky. There are people that are still being held captive today in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and I don't want to talk about their cases because it doesn't help. I think publicity doesn't help. You know, most of them are Afghans and Pakistanis, and they're the ones who really suffer the most. I guess my answer on ransom is it's a question of degrees. I don't think it, you know, would have, I don't know, served the greater good for them to have gotten $25 million from me and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. You know, it really depends on who the kidnapper is. There are many criminal groups that grab, you know, journalists and aid workers. And, you know, if there's a way to kind of, you know, quickly end, you know, a kidnapping without a loss of life for, I don't know what a reasonable amount of money is, but, you know, not millions of dollars, you know, I think that's permissible. But the U.S. government does maintain its policy of not paying ransoms. The British don't pay, and the Canadians don't pay. And that's a serious thing, and they do it. There was just a British hostage last year killed in North Africa. He was kidnapped by a group called Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb. There were European hostages with him, I believe a German and a French national, and they were freed. And there were some prisoners released from one of the governments in North Africa, and they were freed. But the group demanded the release of a very senior Al-Qaeda member, I believe named Abu Qatada, from a British jail. The British refused to do that, and they, you know, decapitated Edwin Dyer. He was a British tourist who had been grabbed. So it's a really difficult issue. I'm sorry, I don't have a clearer answer.
Yes, over here. Thank you. If you, again, go to the microphone.
My name's Rachel Goodman-Davis. I'm not affiliated with anyone. This is sort of a related question, because even though the government, like the U.S. government, doesn't pay ransom, my understanding is that pretty much anyone in your situation would have kidnapping insurance. And I was wondering how that industry affects, you know, people who do your kind of work or other contractors, and whether you think that people like the Taliban are aware of, you know, the extent to which people are insured for kidnapping, and whether that's undermining the U.S. government's policy of not paying ransom, and how you feel about, were you insured? I don't know.
I would be happy to speak to you about this after the meeting. I think that the discussion of the issue is publicly doesn't sort of help the situation, but I'd be more than happy to talk about it afterwards.
Yes, and then over there.
My name is Steve Adler. I'm writing a book chapter on the Taliban. You mentioned, or you said that you were sort of in a parallel or alternate world when you were with them, and I was wondering whether they referred to any real activities of the Taliban during the time that the Taliban actually controlled Afghanistan, because, as you know, the Taliban wiped out opium poppy growing from one year to the next, and that's documented by the United Nations and so forth. So we have Ahmed Rashid, a fellow journalist, writing all kinds of wonderful things about his unique position investigating the Taliban. And we have a distinctive statement from him, speaking of alternate universes, that the Taliban wiped out opium poppy growing from one year to the next because the price had collapsed from $600 to $30 after 3 years of bumper crops. But as a journalist, you may have already seen the UN data and Ahmed Rashid's own data from his book, The Taliban, that show that at the time he says it was $600, it was only $30. So as far as alternate universes are concerned, it appears that most of us who pay attention to people like Ahmed Rashid are really in an alternate universe. And did your alternate universe Taliban discuss the opium poppy ban?
They didn't discuss opium particularly. I mean, they definitely saw drug use as sort of, they're deeply religious and they oppose drug use in general. That would be, they talked about Westerners being hedonists who use drugs, and that was wrong and that was a sin. They cheered during the Mumbai attacks because they said the people in the luxury hotels deserved to die because they were using alcohol, and they saw the hotels as dens of prostitution. In terms of Ahmed Rashid specifically, I don't know the numbers on the poppy, and I'm not quite clear what your question is about the poppy.
Ahmed Rashid is a world source of information on the Taliban. Almost everything that he says about the Taliban is his own unique voice, uncorroborated by anything, except in the case of the opium poppy ban. So here is something where we have alternate data from an alternate universe, the United Nations. Some people think it's an alternate universe altogether. And the publicly available data on prices are there on the UN website. The data are also available in Ahmed Rashid's own book.
Yeah.
But Ahmed Rashid says in his alternate universe that the reason the Taliban banned opium from one year to the next is to raise the price because it had collapsed from $600 to $30. But that never happened.
Okay. I don't know if he, you know, made a mistake in his book. I generally believe Ahmed Rashid's reporting is accurate. I don't think he's part of some conspiracy to defame the Taliban. In terms of Ahmed Rashid specifically, There was a story about him in a Taliban magazine that my captors showed to me, and it specifically said they despise Ahmed Rashid. They said he was a CIA agent, which is ridiculous. He's not at all. He's written bitter attacks on the U.S. policy. His more recent book, Descent into Chaos, attacks them. But I would just say, there's no question there are mistakes in Western reporting from Afghanistan. There's no question the United States has made many mistakes in the war on terror. But nothing, there was by far worse abuses being carried out by the Taliban in the tribal areas, the open bigotry that I talked about. I just don't think it's comparable. I would say that what the hardline Taliban are doing is far worse than
Just the last
US
word, since you mentioned
I don't want to have a sort of ongoing
dialogue.
Can I just
read this quote from Descent into Chaos? Half a sentence from Descent into Chaos. Ahmed Rashid, Descent into Chaos. It later became clear that the ban had been the result of overproduction and a slump in opium prices, which had collapsed from $600 to just $30 a kilo. It's garbage.
Okay.
Thank you for your question.
I would say, just on this, we do a lot of work on drug issues, and I think most of the people who I know who work on drug issues agree with Ahmed Rashid on that. I'll tell you my own story on it, and that is that about 6 weeks or so after 9/11, I was invited to dinner by the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. And I don't ordinarily get that kind of invitation, and I was curious, so I went. I was one of half a dozen guests at that dinner. And the Iranian ambassador, before we sat down to dinner, launched into a speech about how at that moment Khatami was still the president of Iran. This is before Ahmadinejad. The Iranians had sought a rapprochement with the United States following 9/11. They based that in part on their mutual hatred of the Taliban. They had been rebuffed by the United States, and the dinner was held to complain about that rebuff. And the principal evidence or the principal basis he cited for the mutual hatred of the Taliban is that he talked about injecting drug use in Iran. Iran probably has the highest number of injecting drug users of any country in the world. He said the figure was 1.2 million injecting drug users. Some people will use a figure of closer to 2 million. And he talked about the cost to the Iranian government, and he talked about the battles with drug traffickers by Iranian police and the number of Iranian police who had been killed in such battles with drug traffickers. And he blamed the entire thing on the Taliban. And he saw the Taliban as earning immense amounts of money by trafficking drugs into Iran. There had been a traditional practice in Iran of men smoking opium, in the contemporary period, it has been easier and more profitable to convert the opium into heroin. It's easier to smuggle, among other things. But of course, heroin is generally taken by injection. Opium was generally smoked, and so converting the traditional opium users into heroin users was extremely dangerous for Iran. But at least my sense was that the Iranian government was probably in good faith at that time. In expressing their hatred for the Taliban, because of their central role in drug trafficking. Anyway, let's go on to the next matter.
My name is Edward Kaback. I'm a lawyer, an occasional writer, a poet, and not affiliated with any governmental organizations. And as I mentioned, I did honeymoon in Afghanistan, India, and Nepal a long time ago in the early 70s. I have three related questions, and I've read part of the book. It's a wonderful book. One is, what are your views generally, what were your views generally in terms of whether the U.S. should be in Afghanistan? Did they give any credence to the role of the Russians or the British in the 19th century? Two, have your views significantly changed in any way since your kidnap? And the third question is, do you give any credibility to the argument that was used in Vietnam and to some extent is used here, and that is that we can't afford to leave Afghanistan because it would diminish to some extent our superpower status?
In the wake of the kidnapping, I'm much more concerned about the tribal areas of Pakistan. Faisal Shahzad, who tried to set off the truck bomb in Times Square that didn't detonate, was trained in exactly the same place where I was held captive, North Waziristan. So I think that the tribal areas of Pakistan are a direct security threat to the United States. I think that the United States' sort of status as a superpower isn't an issue and shouldn't matter. In terms of what's happening now, I believe that if three things don't happen, the surge of troops will fail in Afghanistan. I don't think we can just sort of abandon the region and everything will be fine. I think we'd be abandoning many moderates who are there already, and I do think there's these attacks that could be carried out in the United States. The first thing would be to get the Pakistanis to be more aggressive about the Taliban. I want to explain, though, why the Pakistani military is backing the Taliban. This is actually from a leaked WikiLeaks cable written by Ambassador Ann Patterson, who then was the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad. And it talks about, it talks in the U.S. government about how do they, get the Pakistani military to sever its ties with the Taliban. She wrote, "Justified or not, increase Indian investment in trade with and development support to the Afghan government, which the United States government has encouraged, causes Pakistan to embrace Taliban groups all the more closely as anti-India allies. We need to reassess Indian involvement in Afghanistan and our own policies towards India, including the growing military relationship. All of this feeds Pakistani establishment paranoia and pushes them closer to both Afghan and Kashmir-focused terrorist groups." And later on she adds, "No amount of money will sever that link." So the first would be pressuring the Pakistanis to do more. The second thing would be asking India to, in essence, back off in Afghanistan. I think the India-Pakistan rivalry sort of playing out in Afghanistan. And the third thing would be to confront the Karzai government on corruption. The lever the U.S. does have is this tremendous amount of money they're putting into the country. And I don't think they should do this publicly. Shaming people does not work, and it angers people very much in South Asia. But privately threatening to reduce the money, unless Karzai gets serious, would help. If you don't do that, if you don't deal with corruption and get more legitimacy in the U.S. government and don't eliminate these sanctuaries, I don't think the surge will work. I also don't think we should just leave. I think that that's too simplistic and that there are really dangerous groups that operate, particularly in the border areas.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Rachel Hart, Open Society Institute. I have two questions. One, I was curious, did the New York Times provide you with any hostile environment training before you left for Afghanistan, and did you think that that was helpful at all, or can sort of nothing really prepare you for being kidnapped? Also, were you able, during the 7 months that you were held in captivity, were you able to record what was going on? Did you have access to journals, or did they not allow any of that?
I took a one-week hazardous environment training class from a security firm. All reporters do that, and that's pretty standard for the industry. They did have a mock kidnapping as part of that one-week training. And the lesson, all I remembered was the goal is to keep yourself alive. And that was part of my answers about money and prisoners and millions. So it was helpful, and that's sort of, what most reporters get as well. In terms of taking notes, I was really afraid they would see me as a spy. And I did, like, I would say, you know, 30 seconds into the kidnapping, I was essentially trying to survive and not trying to report. I wasn't sure I was ever going to write anything if I ever got out. It took me kind of months to start doing that. And, you know, they just would have been enormously suspicious of me taking notes about anything. They just, as I talked about Ahmed Rashid, they sort of see all journalists as spies. There seemed to be more neutrality somewhat in the 90s when myself and colleagues covered the war in Bosnia. At least, you know, now, you know, if you're a journalist, you're just seen as a sort of party to the conflict. They told me, you know, you're an American, therefore you're guilty for all the sins of the American government.
I just want to add one thing on the notes. On the outside, I kept, I recorded all our phone calls with each other and with the Taliban, so we had those to go back to. We had the videos. I also kept really extensive notes and emails back and forth with government officials, notes from security updates, from meetings with the New York Times, because I knew if and when David ever got out, he'd want to know what happened on the outside. Some of the former hostages I had spoke to, you know, had no idea what kind of was happening, and they said they had wished someone had kind of kept track.
Okay, I think we've got time, let's say, for two more questions. So go ahead, and then over here.
Hi, Sana Manasavi from the Open Society Foundations. You touched briefly on drone attacks, and I'd like to see if you can go into more detail about that, because, you know, we have the debate that they effectively target militants or that they hit a lot of civilians and that they're a way to kind of bolster civilian support for the Taliban. So I'd be interested in hearing more about your take on it.
It's both. The closest, you know, occurrence I had was a drone strike that occurred right outside of our house. This was when we were in McKean, South Waziristan. Two cars were driving by that had Arab and Pakistani militants in them, and the strike was so close, the missiles did hit the cars, that there was, like, pieces of shrapnel that landed in our yard. They did only kill the militants that were in those cars, this one strike. My guards were furious about what had happened, what they ended up doing, there was talk initially of killing me in revenge, but they didn't do that. And they ended up arresting a local farmer who they accused of being a spy that had somehow guided the strike. He denied it. They then tortured him. The Taliban, I was told, chopped off the farmer's leg, and then they disemboweled him. At that, you know, point, he allegedly confessed. They then decapitated him and hung his body in the local market as a warning to other villagers. So it's a sort of terrifying police state that the Taliban operate in the tribal areas today. Many local people are blamed for being spies when they're not. I do think that it's sort of the drone strikes create a stalemate. The Taliban, you know, there are civilians killed in other strikes. They do use that to recruit people. I think people, you know, Pakistanis in other parts of the country, you know, there are opinion polls that show the only part of Pakistan that supports the drone strikes are actually the people that live in the tribal areas. And I think that's possible because they are so fearful of the Taliban. The Taliban have murdered hundreds of tribal elders. I mean, it's really brutal there. But in other parts of Pakistan, people are furious about the drone strikes. So it does kind of eliminate top militants, but it creates some support for them. And again, the only thing that's going to change the situation is the Pakistani army going into North Waziristan with troops on the ground. The drone strikes are sort of an interim solution that just creates this stalemate, and they're not as, you know, I think they're not as effective as the U.S. intelligence community claims, but they're also not as careless as critics complain, if that makes any sense.
If I could add to that a bit, I've heard a well-informed Pakistani journalist say that 90% of those killed in the drone strikes are civilians. And then I've seen, you know, the study that was done by the New America Foundation, and essentially they say that as best they're able to determine, about 80% of those who are killed are actual combatants. So there does seem to be an enormous gap between popular belief in Pakistan and what one can actually determine about who gets killed in the drone strikes. So I think the harm they do in terms of public opinion is actually disproportionately higher than ought to be the case, given, in fact, what is going on. And how one deals with a problem of that sort seems to me a very difficult question.
There were about 8 or 10 strikes when I was there. And almost every time, I remember the guards being angry because some, you know, senior commander or some foreign militant had been killed in the strike. And there was, you know, they do fire the civilians. Like the strike that killed Baitullah Massoud killed his wife and children, and they definitely, with a high-level target, they will send a missile into a building that has women and children with them. But, you know, it did seem like it was also very frustrating to them because the strikes were killing commanders and foreigners that helped them.
Right. Over here.
This question is for Ms. Mulvihill. Just because I wanted to focus on, you know, you said that you were, like, thrown into this, so it's, like, a kind of a purely, like, American thrown into this whole thing. Yeah. So, you know, being in the magazine industry, did your husband's kidnapping have any effect on your work? And at first that the fashion, makeup industry can, like, kind of seem a little bit trifle yeah. when your husband's over.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then, when, like, that's going on. And then second of all, like, hearing the propaganda that the Taliban have against us, you know, being opulent, dressing minimally, you know, what they have, especially against us women. And how did that make your, like, you view your work differently? Maybe your values that question American values, magazines' values, or your own, and the importance of it all?
I was definitely thankful that I still had my maiden name and they couldn't Google and find out I worked at Cosmopolitan. you know, the magazine that likes to think it celebrates women's sexuality and whatnot, I think that would have been a real problem. And just celebrate, you know, everything that's sort of temporary in culture, you know, celebrity and money, all of that. And then on the day-to-day, you know, initially having work was a way to have some sense of normalcy, even though what I did wasn't completely normal. but over time, that you know, it was comic relief at times to be working on like a photo shoot with, you know, with male models and whatnot. But over time, it became a lot to sort of juggle the two worlds. You know, we were getting figures from the Taliban and what they thought they wanted for David. And I was negotiating for, like, beach houses in Malibu for cover shoots, things like that. I will say some of the skills I had from working in women's magazines, even though the emphasis is on entertaining and somewhat trivial, you know, I was used to dealing with difficult personality types and multitasking and catastrophizing. You know, as a producer, you have to imagine everything that could go wrong and try to prevent it. And in addition to trying to get David out, the largest goal was not getting him killed. So, you know, we'd catastrophize for hours over communications and things like that. And I will say, you know, in terms of a next step for me, I'm not quite sure. My workplace was tremendously supportive. They kept the secret about his case. They also let me, I was very fortunate, they let me hire a freelancer to come in 3 days a week so I could be running off to D.C. to meet with officials. You know, and there were, the content of the magazine, you know, I didn't always agree with, but there were good people working there and, you know. So for me, I'm not quite sure what the next step is. I would love to still be at a place where I'm creating images, but I'm not quite sure if that'll take the form of women's magazines going forward. So it has made me question. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. As you can see, it's a riveting story. So if you haven't acquired the book, I recommend that you do so. It's called A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. And thank you very much, David. Thank you very much, Kristen.
Thank you.